You gonna make it? Hey, hang in there. 2 days, you got it. 1 week from today, there will be no quiz. A week from Wednesday, you will get the opportunity to confirm that you filled out the evaluation, and that will be the equivalent of a quiz. So the quizzes, for all practical purposes, are history. And that's good for you, and that's good for me. What I'd like to do is just go back and review quickly the first class of drugs we talked about, just got started, that are used to treat cancer. We're going to spend today and half of a week from today talking about the drugs that are used to treat cancer. If you recall, we began with a class of drugs called alkylating agents. Drugs that, under physiological conditions, or as we will see, with some activation, with other examples, give rise to typically a carbonium ion or a carbon an electron deficient species that seeks out, reacts with some electron rich species to form a covalent bond. Covalent bond is formed in activating the structure that's the target. Typically, but not exclusively, this is DNA. And we looked first at a group of compounds called nitrogen mustards, which are bifunctional. They have two arms, a right hand and a left hand. And we saw that mechlorethamine is an example thereof, reacts to give this ammonium that can open to produce this carbonium ion, a la here, that seeks out and reacts with an electron-rich site. It happens to be the 7 position of guanine to form here the covalent bond. This causes tautomerization here in this ketone-alcohol combination and allows for... Now we've used the left arm. Now we're going to do the same process in the right arm. And one of the results of this is cross-linking of the DNA. The other result is mispairing of the DNA. So as a result of alkylation and tautomerization, the base can now mispair, and that's another consequence. And this leads to breakdown in the DNA, removal of the purines that are alkylated in depurination. And we'll see increased amounts of uric acid are one of the consequences. Now, these alkylating agents that we're talking about, exemplified by nitrogen mustards, are mutagens and carcinogens. And they have the potential to result in treatment-induced tumors many years later, typically leukemias, and they can occur 5, 10, 15 years after treatment for a particular tumor. So it's one of the downsides, one of the risk factors associated with the use of these compounds. Neoplastic cells become resistant to nitrogen mustards by several mechanisms, two of which is, one, they can increase the rate of repair. In other words, they can remove this alkyl group or this alkylation site, this alkylation or alkylated entity. They can repair the damage before the damage results in, progresses to a cytotoxic effect in the tumor. The other technique that they have for neutralizing these compounds is to trap them out. In other words, before this carbonium ion can react with this electron-rich nitrogen, sulfhydryl groups react and trap, eliminate, neutralize the alkylating agent. Mechlorethamine has two types of toxicity associated with its use. One is, there is an acute effect that happens right after the drug is given. And these, or effects, I guess, these effects are centrally mediated and they involve nausea and vomiting. And then there is the dose limiting, the thing that limits how often one can treat a patient with this drug. The dose limiting toxicity is bone marrow suppression. That's going to be a refrain over and over and over. And what we will see is, if you can find a compound that doesn't have bone marrow depression as the dose-limiting toxicity, that becomes a really valuable agent in the combinations that are used to treat cancers. Yes?
When you say dose-limiting, is it the amount given at each administration or how frequent the administrations
are? It's how frequent the administrations are. Okay? In other words, bone marrow, and it'll vary from drug to drug or combination from combination. Bone marrow, if this is the beginning of treatment, bone marrow and reaches a low point or a nadir and then recovers. Some do it more rapidly, some do it more slowly. The recovery dictates when you can treat that patient with a second round of chemo. Is it every 4 weeks? Is it every 6 weeks? Is it every 2 weeks? That becomes very important because we're dealing with, because these are drugs that are non-cell cycle specific. They don't depend on the cell cycle, but they all work best when the cell is dividing. So if you're talking about a tumor that's dividing and particularly rapidly dividing where these are really effective, you don't want to delay out 6 weeks between treatment cycles or treatment intervals. Clinically, this drug is used really in one primary protocol, and that is in the treatment of Hodgkin's disease. There is a protocol called MOP therapy, M-O-P-P. There are acronyms out the, let's say, ears, okay, in this area. I'm going to give you just a couple. MOP is a classic one, okay? And it is the treatment for the protocol, and we'll get to it at the end when we've introduced all of the drugs, for Hodgkin's disease. And obviously, the M is metchloroethamine. That's sort of the template for alkylating agents. Now I'm going to introduce you to one other nitrogen mustard, probably the most widely used alkylating agent, period. And this is cyclophosphamide. And it has a number of interesting features associated with it. One, it is given orally. And two, it must be biologically activated. So where metchloroethamine was a vesicant, caused extensive damage at the site of administration, a really toxic chemical to administer. Now you have an orally active compound in cyclophosphamide, and you have a compound that has to be biologically activated. So here's how it works. Here's cyclophosphamide. In order for it to function as a cytotoxic agent, it has to be activated or it has to undergo hydroxylation by the liver enzyme, cytochrome P450 system. The hydroxycyclophosphamide that's formed has several fates. One option is to an inactive metabolite, but more importantly, this compound can open up. In other words, it can exist both as a six-membered ring system as well as an opened ring entity called aldophosphamide. And this aldophosphamide can then break in two. It can cleave right here to produce a byproduct called acrolein and to produce the phosphoramide mustard. Now, the M here on cyclophosphamide stands for the mustard entity, the nitrogen with two arms, right hand, right arm, left arm. So hydroxylation, tautomerization, or an equilibrium here to the opened ring, cleavage to produce this entity, phosphoramide mustard, which is the active alkylating agent that functions just like machloroethamine. Seeks out electron-rich sites, cycles to produce a carbonium ion, forms covalent bonds, leads to da-da-da-da-da-da. Cells become resistant to cyclophosphamide by the same mechanisms as machloroethamine. That is, they repair the damage before the damage can result in death of the cell, and they detoxify, neutralize by trapping with, for example, sulfhydryl groups, the active species. Now, I might just preface this because you're going to hear the same thing over and over again, and that is, these mechanisms are not worth memorization, okay? You just need to be aware of how the drug or how the cancer cell overcomes the presence of the poison. There will be some examples later on where the mechanism of resistance can or is of importance, and I'll emphasize that. Now, in terms of toxicity, there's the immediate, which is invariably, and that's true of almost all of these agents, immediate effect is nausea and vomiting. And we are going to see that there is a whole spectrum from mild to very severe nausea and vomiting that these agents, these cancer drugs, can induce. So centrally mediated as well as GI mediated nausea and vomiting is a side effect. Alopecia is a side effect, not one that would determine or deter treatment. And bone marrow depression is the dose-limiting toxicity. There's another toxicity that is associated with and unique to cyclophosphamide, and that is the ability to produce a hemorrhagic cystitis. About 20% of patients treated with this drug will have dysuria. They will have decreased urinary frequency. And the hemorrhagic blood and urine, the hemorrhagic cystitis, is the result of the byproduct here, acrolein. One can prevent or one can reduce the severity and the incidence of the hemorrhagic cystitis by hydration and by introducing a compound into the hydrating media called MESNA, which stands for mercaptan ethyl sulfonic acid sodium salt. All it is it's a sulfhydryl that can react or trap out acrolein. It reacts at this beta carbon, bingo, here. And it's a sulfonic acid that is highly ionized, going to find its place in the urine. So it's going to be in the urine, highly ionized, filtered, and eliminated. And it traps out acrolein, reduces the concentration of acrolein in the bladder, and diminishes and or prevents the hemorrhagic cystitis. I said that cyclophosphamide is the most widely used nitrogen mustard. Its use extends to a variety of clinical situations. It's used to treat chronic lymphocytic leukemias, It's used to treat non-Hodgkin lymphomas. Never alone. These are always in various multiple drug combinations. I think that's understood. It's used to treat a variety of solid tumors, breast, lung, ovarian cancers as examples. It is also a potent immunosuppressant agent and has been used to manage patients with rheumatoid arthritis and various autoimmune disorders. Now, when I give you examples of how a drug is used, there will be some at the end that we will talk about where the protocol is absolutely established. But for most of these, there are multiple protocols for treating a breast cancer, colon cancer, et cetera, et cetera. It is beyond what you need to know. Okay? So the clinical use of these drugs are representative or examples of the kinds of situations in tumors that these drugs are used against. Okay, we've looked at nitrogen mustards. Chemists have searched to see if they can identify other classes of alkylating agents. And the next one we're going to look at is a class of compounds that are called nitrosourea. And there are several of these compounds. Let's just focus on one. This is a substance, carmustine, or BCNU, sometimes it is referred to. There is a cousin, a relative, called lomustine. Again, similar active portion. This one happens to be orally active. This is a typical nitrosourea. If you just allow me to stand here, there's the urea, nitrogen, CONH, and it has a nitroso group associated with one of the nitrogens, and then again, it has two arms. It has a right arm and a left arm. And the nitrosoureas function, on the one hand, like alkylating agents. That is, they cleave and generate, in this case, an ethyl carbonium ion that can alkylate just like nitrogen mustards. The other portion of the molecule that cleaves gives rise to what's called an isocyanate. And this isocyanate group can chemically react with sulfhydryl groups, epsilon amino groups in various proteins. It can react with nucleophiles found in proteins to form a covalent bond. So this can attach or react with proteins. So the molecule has really two ways to work, both of which to a degree represent alkylation. Now, the mechanism then is the same. Alkylation of nucleic acid, reaction of the isocyanate with proteins that are involved in RNA and DNA synthesis that leads ultimately to a cytotoxic effect in the cell. The mechanism of resistance that appears to be of greatest importance for the nitrosoureas is the same or are the same mechanisms we saw with the alkylating agents, the nitrogen mustards. Increased repair, increased inactivation by sulfhydryl groups. One of the interesting things is there's no cross resistance with nitrogen mustards. So cancer cells that become resistant to cyclophosphamide will still be sensitive to nitrosourea. Now, in terms of toxicity, the dose limiting is a delayed bone marrow suppression. And by delayed, I mean 4 to 6 weeks. And so this very much dictates the frequency with which the drug can be administered. One way to overcome that is to use various recombinant hematopoietic growth factors. And it's used with nitrosourea, but these are used with others as well. Erythropoietin to stimulate red blood cells, and a second factor called granulite colony stimulating factor. It goes by the trade name filgastrum, or it goes by the abbreviation G-CSF. These hematopoietic growth factors can be given to a patient to stimulate the recovery of the bone marrow in severe bone marrow, and here, severe delayed bone marrow depression. It is true as well as we will see with other agents. Now here's the clinical use. This is the feature that makes these compounds have their niche of value, and that is these are lipid-soluble compounds. They cross the blood-brain barrier, and they are used to treat brain tumors. They've also been used to treat certain lymphomas, but their clinical niche is the result of lipid solubility allowing diffusion across the blood-brain barrier that makes them effective for the treatment of central nervous system tumors. Now, yes, carmustine, one is oral, carmustine is IV, the other is oral, okay? So the orally active one is still sufficiently lipid-soluble to cross over. Now, I've put a compound down here that you may or may not be familiar with. It's called streptozocin, or streptozotocin. You may know it as streptozotocin. It is a nitrosourea. It's made by a bug. So it's really an antibiotic. It's called streptozotocin, and it's a nitrosourea. So it works by the same mechanism, and its utility is in the treatment, or the destruction, if you like, of islet cells in the pancreas that are cancerous. In the laboratory, this is used to induce diabetes in animals by destroying islet cells. In the clinic, it's used to treat islet cell tumors. And it functions like the other nitrosoureas, but is not synthetic. Yes? It appears not to be the case. Oh, with this drug? Oh, with streptozotocin, absolutely, and exacerbate the diabetes. Yep. You know, there's no induction of diabetes that I'm aware of with nitrosoureas. Could you induce it in a patient? I can't imagine why you would want to do it.
No, I'm just saying if you're treating their cancer,
In other words, do the nitrosoureas damage islet cells? No. Does streptozotocin damage islet cells? Yes.
So would
Yeah, let's say they have cancer, breast cancer. Would that induce diabetes? Absolutely, without a doubt. Would you give it? Absolutely not. Okay. You only give it for this specific purpose. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're going to move to a class that's sort of kinky. Another group of alkylating agents, but alkylating agents that don't look like and resemble anything we have seen previously, or I must say, anything we will see into the future. These are heavy metal. This is not a rock band, okay? But heavy metal complexes, and these are platinum complexes. And the prototype compound here is a compound called cisplatin. This was the first. There are now other platinum complexes that have been formed. Let me just tell you the history of cisplatin because it's sort of interesting. This is not for you to write down, okay? It was, as so many things, discovered by accident. There was a man, a faculty member at Michigan State University, that was intrigued by the resemblance, the similarity between the mitotic spindle development when a cell is dividing and iron filings in the presence of magnets. You know how they line up. And so he said to himself, "Self, I wonder what would happen if you took cells in culture and you induced an electromagnetic force. What would happen to cells that are dividing in the presence of an electromagnetic force?" And so what he did is, and I think these were bacteria, but I'm not positive the cell source. Put cells in culture, placed platinum electrodes in the culture, generated an electromagnetic force. The culture medium had some ammonium chloride in it. And what he saw was that cell division was inhibited. He was a biologist, okay? So he didn't know any chemistry. He goes and talks to the chemists, and the chemists say, "Gee, what's probably happening is the platinum electrodes in the presence of the ammonium chloride, you're generating a platinum complex with the chlorine and the nitrogen, this coordinated complex." So the chemists made the coordination complex and they tested it and it was inactive because the thermodynamically most stable form of the platinum is trans platinum. That is, I assume you know cis and trans, where the chlorines, one here and one here, not the cis where they are on the same side. So then the chemist said, and what they did is they let the compound, the trans, sit out on the bench as crystals, and under the influence of UV light, it converted to, under UV stimulation, to the cis compound that worked exactly like was observed in the solution. Thus, the discovery and the utilization of cisplatin, and I'm going to talk you through the pharmacology of cisplatin because this is a really important drug, or this class of drugs, and they have some unique side effects. It works. Its mechanism is believed to be identical to the alkylating agents in that the platinum dissociates, making this positively charged. The platinum then becomes positively charged, seeks out an electron-rich site, and it alkylates. For example, DNA. Since there are two chlorines, one has the potential for the two-armed effect, and so it can cross-link or it can monoalkylate. And that then alters the DNA, makes it dysfunctional, and brings about, consequently, a cytotoxic effect. Cells become resistant to cisplatin by the same mechanisms as the other alkylating agents. Now, there are several things that make this drug unique. One is it causes severe persistent vomiting. This is one of the most potent cancer drugs in its ability to induce emesis. The emesis can begin within an hour of the patient receiving the drug and can continue for days. In fact, patients can become so conditioned, you probably know this, so conditioned to this effect that the thought, even the reflection of the clinic, the setting, the nurse, the smell can induce emesis. The anticipatory emesis occurs with this compound. One can diminish the severe emesis or vomiting associated with it by pre-treating the patient with anti-emetic compounds, which we'll talk about a week from Wednesday. These compounds are, I'll give you two names. One is called ondansetron, ondansetron. It is a serotonin H3 receptor antagonist. There are a whole class of these. There's another class that are dopamine D2 receptor antagonists that are used to prevent vomiting. And an example thereof is metoclopramide, M-E-T. It's meto, M-E-T-O-C-L-O. P-L-A-M-I-D-E. So one of the toxicities associated with cisplatin is severe, persistent, extended vomiting. The second major side effect is nephrotoxicity. It is dose-dependent. It is cumulative. And it involves the distal convoluted tubules and the collecting ducts. And it leads to loss of potassium, magnesium, decreased glomerular filtration, and potentially renal failure. It is slowly reversible, assuming the severity has not become so great where one then only has partial reversing. One can reduce the nephrotoxicity in two ways. One can reduce it by giving mannitol, which produces an osmotic diuresis, which leads to increased blood flow and improve tubular function. And one can add to the mannitol a compound that reacts or traps out called sodium thiosulfate. So by putting sodium thiosulfate along with mannitol, the mannitol induces an osmotic diuresis. The sodium thiosulfate traps out in the kidney cisplatin and neutralizes it. It is also a compound that can produce ototoxicity. Patients will complain of tinnitus, loss of high-frequency sounds, and this, again, is partially reversible. Depending on severity, it can be partially reversible. If detected early on, fully reversible. So here's the baggage: vomits, nephrotoxicity, ototoxicity, but what it lacks is bone marrow suppression. So you can see where this is going. It now then becomes a drug that becomes very valuable in combination therapy for treating tumors in combinations where the other agents in the combination have bone marrow as a limiting toxicity. So how is it used? It's used to treat a variety of solid tumors, particularly metastatic testicular cancer. This is probably the drug, it's used in combination, this is probably the drug that has revolutionized the treatment of testicular cancer from 90%+ fatal to probably under 10% currently with various protocols. It's used in combination with several other drugs. It's also used in the treatment of ovarian cancer and in the treatment of bladder cancers as examples. There's one last alkylating agent that I want to talk about, and we can dispose of this fairly quickly. There's a compound called procarbazine, and this is the structure of procarbazine. And this compound is a cytotoxic agent, and it works probably by two different mechanisms. One, according to Hoyle, it alkylates. So it gives rise to a methyl carbonium ion that can alkylate DNA, just as we saw with the other agents. In addition, it is a hydrazine, and this hydrazine can oxidize to this azo and produce hydrogen peroxide. And there is evidence that the hydrogen peroxide that's generated leads to DNA strand breakage. So it has two ways to work. One is by oxidant insult damage strand break. The other is by alkylation of DNA. Cells become resistant most likely by the same mechanisms we've talked about, although the precise mechanisms have not been delineated. The primary toxicity that one sees with procarbazine is bone marrow depression. It is also neurotoxic. That is, it can lead to drowsiness, hallucinations, depression in the patient because it gets into the central nervous system, and there is some evidence that it functions as an inhibitor of monoamine oxidase. So patients, if indeed it is an inhibitor, and we know that it is an inhibitor of monoamine oxidase, patients need to be advised not to consume foods that are rich in tyramine, cheese, beer, wine, examples, because of the resultant blockade of their metabolism and the pressor effects that result. How is this drug used? It is used in the treatment of Hodgkin's disease. It is part of MOP therapy. It's one of the P's. There is a relative, a close relative, in fact, a very close relative of procarbazine called decarbazine that works by the same mechanism, alkylation, and that also is used in MOP therapy interchangeably with procarbazine. It's called dacarbazine. And we will come back a week from today and look at protocols for treating Hodgkin's disease using MOP therapy as an example, and then alternate protocols, and dacarbazine is involved. Okay, we're going to change directions now. Here's where we've been. We've looked at one box of many boxes of drugs that are used to treat cancer that all work by alkylating. And there were many sub-boxes. Now we're going to move, and we saw that they were all cell cycle nonspecific. Didn't matter where the cell was in the cycle, but they all work best when the cell is cycling. Now we're going to move to a class of drugs, type of drugs, another box, that are all cell cycle specific, and they are anti-metabolites. They are fakes. They're knockoffs. They are lookalikes, but they are fraudulent in terms of their effectiveness, their utility. And there are going to be three lookalikes that we're going to examine. Anti-metabolites of folic acid, anti-metabolites of purines, anti-metabolites of pyrimidines. And the place we're going to begin is to look at really a key drug, which is a folic acid antagonist, okay, called methotrexate. This has considerable clinical utility, both as an anti-cancer drug and we'll see in a bit as an immunosuppressant agent. Here are the changes. This is the chemical structure of methotrexate. The changes were in folic acid, this would be a hydrogen, and in folic acid, this would be a hydroxyl. So chemists changed the hydroxyl to amino, changed the hydrogen to a methyl group, a la methotrexate. Now, methotrexate works by first being actively transported into a cell. So methotrexate is actively transported into cells, and it simply hops aboard one of the various transporters that transport folates from dietary sources into our cells. So methotrexate gets transported into the cell. Once inside the cell, methotrexate, just like folic acid, becomes polyglutamated. Here's the glutamic acid residue on methotrexate, and what the cell does, just as it does for folic acids, it attaches multiple glutamates. And the polyglutamated species of the drug persists in the cell long after the blood level. It basically is trapped or ion trapped in the cell. The methotrexate that's transported and polyglutamated functions as a competitive inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase. It binds with tremendous affinity for the active site of dihydrofolate reductase. So as a result, again, dihydrofolate reductase takes folic acid to dihydrofolic acid. It also takes dihydrofolic acid to tetrahydrofolic acid. And we saw tetrahydro becomes activated and functions in one carbon transfer reactions. And so inhibition of dihydrofolate reductase starves the cell of cofactors that are critical for the synthesis of thymidylic acid, methionine, serine, or a whole variety of things. And we've looked at this reaction extensively in various scenarios. That is, the thymidylic synthetase catalyzed reaction of uridylic to thymidylic that is the key building block, or a key building block in the synthesis of DNA. So here is a drug that binds and that inhibits or starves the cell of the tetrahydrofolate required cofactor. Cells, we're going to come back to this diagram and then we'll take a break. Cells become resistant to methotrexate by really two mechanisms. One, decreased affinity of dihydrofolic reductase for the enzyme, and secondly, decreased active transport of methotrexate into the cell. So what are the toxic effects, the limiting effects that you see? This drug causes oral and GI ulceration. It can, with long use, lead to pulmonary infiltrates and fibrosis. It also suppresses bone marrow, and it is bone marrow suppression that is the dose-limiting toxicity. Methotrexate is clinically used in a variety of protocols, for example, to treat acute lymphocytic leukemia, to treat Burkitt's lymphoma, to treat breast cancer, head and neck carcinomas as examples. It is also a compound that has significant use as an immunosuppressant agent in the management of lupus, in the management of rheumatoid arthritis. It is also used in very high dose to treat osteogenic sarcomas and a type of cancer called choriocarcinoma. Choriocarcinoma is a tumor associated with fetal trophoblastic tissue. Yeah, choriocarcinoma is all you need to know. Okay? Yeah, osteogenic sarcoma. Okay? In both of these last incidents or examples, it is used in a kind of therapy called rescue therapy. And let me give you the rationale for it and the strategy and how it's used. Let's just use osteogenic sarcoma. Osteogenic sarcoma is a tough form of cancer to treat. And one approach to its treatment has been to give high doses of methotrexate. In part, that is necessitated because osteogenic sarcomas have lost the ability to transport methotrexate into the cell. So by giving high doses of methotrexate, one can get more methotrexate into the cell by passive diffusion. It is sufficiently lipid-soluble to enter by passive diffusion. So a patient is given a high dose of methotrexate that will overcome the active transport deficiency by passively diffusing into the cell. Here's the hooker. It diffuses into normal cells as well as into neoplastic cells. So you have the potential with more drug to get more kill. You also have the potential with more drug in healthy cells to get more side effect. Healthy cells can be rescued. Healthy cells can be rescued by administering leucovorin, better known as folinic acid, that bypasses the blockade. Here's the blockade. So if you give healthy cells leucovorin, you can provide them with the cofactor necessary to continue one carbon transfer reactions. Now, I see some skulls, and you're saying to yourself, well, does this negate the effect of methotrexate? And the answer is no. When leucovorin is used, it is administered at low doses, and normal cells are able to transport it. And there is good evidence that neoplastic cells are less able to. Therefore, one gets better recovery in normal than in neoplastic cells where the leucovorin would antagonize the effect of methotrexate. It is a form of treatment called leucovorin rescue. You are simply giving high doses to overcome resistance here because of diminished active transport. So high doses now of methotrexate in normal and cancerous cells, and then trying to recover or rescue the normal cells by bypassing the blockade, by giving a form of folic acid that can be utilized, and therefore preventing or reversing the effect of the blockade. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and continue the story.